Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
It's just really fantastic to be here for another deep dive into the architecture of academic English.
Yeah, we are so glad to have you back. And, you know, to our listeners, welcome back. We are moving right along.
Right. Last time we were looking at Article Era 1, which was the mirror test.
Exactly. The mirror test. So we spent all that time exploring animal self-awareness and psychology. But today, we are taking a pretty massive leap.
A huge leap, yeah. From animal psychology to, well, consumer psychology.
Right. We are jumping into Article 02 from our official TOEFL academic reading collection, and this one is titled The Paradox of Choice.
It is such a fascinating text. And, you know, our goal here today is to really act as your personal English teachers for this deep dive.
Exactly. We are going to take this reading passage and just break it down paragraph by paragraph.
Because there is some serious C1 level academic vocabulary hidden inside this text, and some pretty complex sentence structures too.
Oh, definitely. We want to untangle all of that. We'll map out the core arguments so that if you, the listener, see a passage like this on test day, you are just completely fully prepared.
Right. We want you to understand not just what the author is saying, but, you know, how and why they're saying it.
Okay, let's unpack this. I want you to visualize a scenario for a second.
Okay, paint the picture.
You walk into a massive, brightly lit electronics store. You are there on a very simple mission, right? You just need a new smartphone.
It seems easy enough.
Right. But you walk up to the central display, and suddenly, your feet feel completely glued to the floor. You are staring at a wall of, like, 50 different glowing glass rectangles.
Oh, I know that feeling so well. They all look exactly the same.
They really do. They look incredibly similar, yet the little placards below them tell this this story of infinite minute differences.
Right. Like, this one has a slightly wider aperture on the third camera lens or whatever.
Exactly. Or this one has a battery that lasts, you know, 12 minutes longer. Or, wait, this one actually folds in half.
Oh, in the materials, right. This one has a titanium bezel, while that one is brushed aluminum.
Yes. So you stand there, and you're reading placard after placard comparing processor speeds and cloud storage limits. And 20 minutes go by.
Then 40 minutes.
Exactly. Your shoulders tense up, your brain feels foggy, and eventually you just turn around and walk right out the glass doors into the parking lot, completely empty-handed.
You feel totally exhausted, stressed out, and strangely defeated, honestly.
Defeated. That is the perfect word. So you have to ask yourself, why does having the absolute freedom to choose from the best technology in the world actually make us feel miserable?
Well, that feeling of defeat in the electronics store is the exact psychological mystery at the heart of today's deep dive.
It's so counterintuitive.
It really is a profound mystery because it completely short-circuits our basic cultural programming, you know?
What do you mean by cultural programming?
Well, we operate on this deeply ingrained assumption that freedom is the ultimate good.
Right.
And that having more options automatically equals more freedom.
Right. More choices equals more freedom. It's like an equation.
Exactly. Therefore, the logic follows more options must equal more happiness. But as we'll see, human neurology doesn't operate like a simple linear equation.
It really doesn't. And that brings us to the core concept introduced right at the beginning of the text.
Right. The author brings up a theory popularized by the psychologist Barry Schwartz.
And the premise is exactly what the title of the article advertises, right? The paradox of choice.
Yes. The fundamental argument here is that while a little bit of choice is certainly better than none at all, an explosion of options actually leads to a severe drop in our overall satisfaction.
What's fascinating here is the immediate cultural backdrop the author uses to frame this problem, because they mention groceries to electronics.
Right. The text states, while the freedom to choose is fundamental to consumer culture, an overabundance of choices can overwhelm individuals.
Okay, let's pause right there. To truly grasp the weight of this argument, especially for our B1 and B2 listeners, we have to look closely at that phrase, consumer culture.
Yeah, that's an important one, because this isn't just about going to the store and buying milk.
No, not at all. It is about an entire societal framework, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's where your personal identity, your social status, and your individual expression are deeply tied to the specific goods and services you select.
I think that's a really crucial distinction to make. In a consumer culture, buying a pair of sneakers isn't just about, you know, protecting your feet from the pavement.
Right, it's so much more than that. You are choosing a brand that signals your values, your aesthetic,
yeah.
your social tribe, basically.
Exactly. The choice becomes a reflection of who you are as a person.
And because we attach so much personal weight to these choices, the act of choosing becomes incredibly high stakes.
It does. Our society equates the ability to walk into a store and pick from 1,000 options with, like, ultimate personal liberty.
Right. So when the author suggests that this very freedom is what is actually making us miserable, it's not just a passing observation.
No, it's a direct challenge to the foundational ideology of modern capitalism.
Which brings us to our first major piece of C1-level academic vocabulary for the listeners. And it's the title of the concept itself, paradox.
Paradox. Let's really look at the mechanics of this word because it's so useful. It's built from ancient Greek roots.
Okay, break that down for us.
So we have the prefix para, which means distinct from, contrary to, or outside of.
Para, meaning contrary to. Right.
Okay. And then we have the root doxa, which translates to opinion, belief, or expectation.
So if we put those two together, a paradox is a situation, an event, or a statement that exists completely contrary to our normal expectations or beliefs.
Precisely. It is a scenario that seems entirely impossible or contradictory on the surface, but when you investigate it, it turns out to be true.
So the doxa, the common belief, is that endless choice brings ultimate happiness.
Right. And the fact that endless choice actually brings anxiety operates para, or contrary to, that belief.
You will see this concept frequently in academic readings, won't you?
Oh, all the time. For instance, in environmental science, you might read about Jevons paradox.
Oh, Jevons paradox. Remind me how that one works.
Well, it's the idea that increasing the energy efficiency of a technology actually increases the total amount of energy consumed rather than decreasing it.
Right. Because it becomes cheaper to use, so people use it way more. That's a perfect example of a paradox. You expect energy use to drop, but it goes up.
Exactly. Whenever you see the word paradox in a reading passage, I tell students to immediately highlight it in their minds.
It's like a giant neon sign.
Right? It really is. It points directly to the author's main argument.
Yeah.
The rest of the passage will almost certainly be dedicated to resolving or explaining that specific contradiction.
That is a phenomenal reading strategy for the TOEFL. Now, let's look at the specific cause of this paradox in our article.
Right. The text blames an overabundance of choices. Yep. Overabundance.
Overabundance. This word is just a wonderful example of how English builds complex ideas through affixes.
Let's unpack it. We start with the core adjective abundant, which means plentiful or existing in large quantities.
Right. Like if a forest is abundant with wildlife, it's just teeming with animals. There are a lot of them.
Exactly. Then we add the suffix to turn that adjective into a noun. Abundance, a state of having plenty.
And finally, the author attaches the prefix over, which denotes excess.
Right. It means crossing a threshold from just a lot into too much.
So an overabundance is a quantity that is so massive it actually becomes problematic. It exceeds our capacity to manage it.
And a quick tip for our listeners on how to use this naturally. Pay attention to collocations.
Yes, collocations are so important. In English, certain words just love to hang out together.
They really do. And overabundance is almost always followed by the preposition of.
So you will encounter an overabundance of caution or an overabundance of data.
Or, as our author notes here, an overabundance of choices.
So what exactly happens to the human mind when it encounters this overabundance? The text introduces a discipline-specific term from psychology here.
Yes, it explains the fallout by calling it decision fatigue.
Decision fatigue. Now, I want to push back a little on how we usually think about this phrase.
Okay, how so?
Well, often people compare decision fatigue to a battery draining. You know, you wake up with 100% battery, every choice takes 1%, and by 8 p.m., your phone is dead.
Right, the battery metaphor is very common.
But that feels a bit too simple to explain the deep anxiety the author is talking about. Isn't there something more mechanical happening in the brain?
You are absolutely right to demand a deeper mechanism there because it is much more complex than just a simple battery draining.
So what's actually going on?
Think about how the prefrontal cortex, which is the analytical decision-making part of your brain, actually processes a choice. It doesn't just look at an item and say yes or no.
No, it has to weigh all the variables.
Exactly. It engages in comparative computation. Mm-hmm. If you have to choose between two different laptops, your brain has to compare the RAM, the processor speed, the weight, the screen resolution, and of course, the price.
And doing that for two laptops is a manageable amount of cognitive friction.
Right. But if you have 50 laptops, your brain is trying to hold the specifications of laptop A in its working memory while comparing it to laptop B.
And then cross-referencing that with laptop C, all while trying to remember the price of laptop D.
It is exactly like opening 400 tabs on your internet browser.
The RAM just maxes out. The whole system crashes.
Yes. The cognitive load becomes computationally impossible for the human brain to process efficiently. That state of being overwhelmed, of total cognitive system failure, is true decision fatigue.
And the result of that internal crash is the severe anxiety the text mentions.
Which leads perfectly into the author's next point. The text states that this vast array of possibilities might actually diminish consumer contentment. Diminish.
Diminish. That is a highly versatile C1 verb. At its core, it just means to decrease, to lessen, or to erode the size or importance of something.
What I love about the author's choice of the word diminish here is that it implies a very gradual process.
Yeah, it doesn't mean your happiness is instantly destroyed in some sudden explosion.
Exactly. It means your contentment is slowly chipped away, piece by piece, with every single exhausting comparison you have to make.
That's a very perceptive reading of the tone there. And why exactly is that contentment diminishing?
Well, the author concludes this thought with an incredibly evocative phrase. They write that the fear of making the wrong choice looms large.
Looms large. Let's unpack the imagery there, because it's a great academic idiom.
To understand the idiom, we have to look at the verb loom. Usually when something looms, it is something large, threatening, and sort of indistinct.
We talk about dark storm clouds looming on the horizon, for example, or a massive mountain looming over a small village. It implies a dark shadow being cast.
So, when a fear or an anxiety looms large in your mind, it means it is taking up a massive amount of psychological real estate.
It is casting a shadow over your entire thought process.
Exactly. And in the context of our paradox, this isn't just the fear of picking a bad product. It is the overwhelming weight of opportunity cost.
Opportunity cost, yes. Let's explore that, because that is the exact mechanism driving this fear.
So in economics, opportunity cost is the value of the next best alternative that you give up when you make a choice.
Okay, so if you choose to spend your Saturday studying for the TOEFL, the opportunity cost is the relaxation you could have had, say, watching a movie with friends.
Precisely. You gave up the movie to study. So when you are staring at 50 smartphones and you finally pick one, you are simultaneously rejecting 49 other possibilities.
And because you had so many options, your brain is just terrified that one of those 49 rejected phones was actually the perfect one.
Right. The ghost of the unchosen options haunts you.
You take your new phone home, and instead of being thrilled, you're sitting there wondering if the other one had a better camera. The fear of that mistake looms large, destroying any joy you might have felt.
That is the absolute essence of the paradox, perfectly articulated.
Now, from a structural standpoint, there is a specific grammatical tool the author uses to introduce this entire complex dynamic in paragraph one.
Yes, it is the concessive clause that opens the discussion. The text says, "While the freedom to choose is fundamental to consumer culture, an overabundance of choices can overwhelm individuals."
The while clause. This is such a critical piece of academic architecture for TOEFL students to master. Why do authors rely on this structure so heavily?
Well, they use it because academic writing is essentially a sophisticated debate.
Right.
A concessive clause, which often starts with words like while, although, even though, or despite, allows the author to acknowledge a widely held belief or a counterargument before they pivot to their actual thesis.
So, by starting with "While the freedom to choose is fundamental," the author is basically saying, look, I know what you all believe. I know our culture loves freedom. I am conceding that point to you.
Exactly. They disarm the reader's defenses by agreeing with them first. But then comes the comma and the big pivot. An overabundance of choices can overwhelm.
The main clause that follows the comma is the author's true argument.
Yes. If you are taking a reading comprehension test and a question asks for the author's primary claim in that paragraph, you must look at the second half of that sentence, not the while clause.
The while clause is just the shield, basically. The main clause is the sword.
That's a great way to remember it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because in academia, you can't just philosophize about opportunity costs and cognitive loads.
No, you need actual empirical data to prove your theories.
Exactly. And the author doesn't just leave us with Barry Schwartz's abstract ideas. They anchor the theory with one of the most famous pieces of behavioral research in the last 30 years.
Yes. The text transitions seamlessly from the theoretical to the empirical by introducing psychologist Sheena Iyengar's groundbreaking jam experiment.
Let's set the scene for this study because it's brilliant. Iyengar and her research team set up a tasting booth in an upscale supermarket.
Right. They basically disguise themselves as normal store employees offering free samples of gourmet jam.
But they manipulated the environment on different days.
Mm-hmm.
On some days, a shopper walking by the booth would see a massive, beautiful display of 24 different varieties of jam.
Wow, 24.
Yeah. But on other days, the display was dramatically reduced, offering only 6 varieties of jam.
The premise is so brilliantly simple, but the behavioral data it produced honestly turned the entire marketing world upside down.
Now, I have to play the skeptic for a moment here.
Okay, go for it.
Let's look at this purely through the lens of mathematical probability. If I am a consumer with very specific tastes, say, I only like tart fruit spreads, or I hate anything with seeds, wouldn't the table with 24 jams offer me a vastly superior mathematical chance of finding a product that aligns perfectly with my preferences?
That's the logical assumption, yes.
Right. Logically, more options should equate to a higher probability of a successful match. So why did the table with only 6 options drastically outperform the massive display in terms of actual sales?
Well, your mathematical logic is entirely sound. But as we discussed earlier, human beings are not calculators. We are biological organisms prone to cognitive overload.
So the math doesn't account for the brain crashing.
Exactly. To answer your question, we have to look at the exact mechanism the text highlights. The author writes that the limited selection eased the decision process and reduced the pressure to find the perfect option.
So it all comes back to that comparative computation we talked about with the laptops.
Precisely. Let's look at the math of the cognitive load. If you are at the table with 6 jams, your brain has to make a relatively small number of comparisons to find the winner.
Right. You compare strawberry to blueberry, peach to blackberry. It's manageable.
It is. But if you have 24 jams, you aren't just looking at 24 single items. You are subconsciously trying to calculate the relative value of hundreds of different paired combinations.
Right. You're thinking, is the boysenberry better than the marionberry? Wait. How did the marionberry compare to the blackcurrant? Oh, no, I forgot what the first one tasted like.
Exactly. The sheer volume of processing required triggers that decision fatigue. And what happens when a human being is faced with an overwhelmingly complex cognitive task in a low-stakes environment like a grocery store?
They just walk away. The brain says, you know what? This isn't worth the energy.
Yes. They default to the path of least resistance, which is making no decision at all. At the table with 6 jams, the experience feels like a fun, low-pressure discovery.
You pick a flavor, you feel confident in your choice, and you buy it. The decision process is, as the text says, eased.
But at the table with 24 jams, picking a spread for your morning toast suddenly feels like a high-stakes exam where there is only one right answer and 23 ways to fail.
That distinction between searching for a good option versus the perfect option is huge.
It really is the key.
When there are only 6 jams, you are just looking for something tasty. You are what psychologists call a satisficer. You find something that satisfies your needs and you stop looking.
But when you see 24 jams, the environment tricks you into becoming a maximizer.
Right. You suddenly feel obligated to optimize your choice and find the absolute pinnacle of jam perfection. And that pressure is just paralyzing.
That is a phenomenal layer of analysis, and it perfectly explains the vocabulary the author uses to summarize this section. The text states, "Research supports this notion."
Let's look at that word notion. It's a great C1 alternative to basic words like idea or thought.
Yes. A notion, in an academic context, is a conception of or a belief about something. It implies a theoretical idea that has been put forward for consideration.
So when the author says research supports this notion, they are linking the empirical data of the jam study back to the theoretical concept of the paradox of choice.
Exactly. And then the text describes the outcome of the experiment by saying, this phenomenon reveals that fewer choices can sometimes make consumers happier. Phenomenon.
Phenomenon. This is a word that appears constantly in academic reading, whether it's astronomy, sociology, or economics.
It does. A phenomenon is an observable fact, event, or circumstance. Crucially, in academia, it usually refers to an event whose cause or explanation is currently in question or under investigation.
Right, like gravity was a phenomenon long before Isaac Newton formulated the mathematics to explain it.
Perfect example. The fact that shoppers buy more jam when offered fewer choices is the observable behavioral phenomenon. The paradox of choice is the theory used to explain it.
I also want to point out the mechanics of this word for our listeners, because it stems from Greek, which means its plural form does not follow standard English rules.
Oh, a vital point for any writing tasks on the TOEFL. If you are describing a single event, it is one phenomenon.
But if you are describing multiple observable events, they are phenomena. P-H-E-N-O-M-E-N-A. Do not write phenomenons.
One phenomenon, many phenomena. Got it.
Now, how does the author suggest we actually apply this knowledge? The text states that retailers can boost satisfaction by curating their offerings. Curating.
This is a word that has absolutely exploded in popularity in the digital age, but its roots are very traditional.
Yeah, to understand curating, we look to the Latin root curare, which means to take care of or to attend to. Historically, we associate this word with a museum curator.
Right. If you go to an incredible art museum, the brilliance of the museum isn't just in how many paintings they own.
No, because a massive pile of art isn't a museum. It's a warehouse. The curator did not just take 10,000 random paintings and nail them to the wall from floor to ceiling.
That would be exhausting to look at.
Exactly. The curator takes care of the visitor's experience by meticulously selecting maybe 50 specific paintings. They organize them by era, by theme, or by color palette. They guide your journey.
That is a brilliant analogy. The curator takes on the massive cognitive load of sorting through the thousands of options so the visitor doesn't have to.
And when we apply curating to retail or business, it means exactly the same thing. A smart business doesn't just dump their entire inventory onto a web page and tell the customer to figure it out.
They act as the expert. They pre-select a limited range of the absolute best products and present them clearly.
And by curating the selection, the retailer absorbs the cognitive friction. They do the hard work of eliminating the bad options,
which frees the consumer to simply enjoy the act of choosing from a pre-approved, manageable list. It completely eliminates the anxiety of the opportunity cost.
Which is why understanding this specific paragraph is so vital for tests like the TOEFL. Academic texts are rarely just abstract theory.
No, they almost always include a pivot to practical application. The author is showing us how a deep psychological insight can dictate real-world economic strategies.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, we see the author take another massive structural leap in paragraph 3.
We started with abstract theory in paragraph 1. We moved to a specific controlled grocery store experiment in paragraph 2. Now, the text zooms all the way out to examine global cultural sociology.
This is the hallmark of sophisticated academic discourse.
Right.
Right? A strong argument doesn't just explain a local phenomenon, it explores how that phenomenon interacts with different systems across the globe.
Absolutely. Let's break down the cultural dichotomy the author sets up here.
Okay, the text explicitly contrasts individualistic cultures with collectivist cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It notes that in individualistic societies, personal choice is highly valued, but this creates a significant burden.
While in collectivist societies, fewer choices are provided, but people report higher levels of contentment.
Let's define these terms, because they are foundational concepts in sociology and cross-cultural psychology.
An individualistic culture, which we heavily associate with Western nations like the United States, the UK, or Australia, operates on the core philosophy that the individual is the primary unit of society.
Right. Independence, self-reliance, and the absolute freedom to forge your own unique path are considered the highest moral goods.
And in an individualistic culture, how you express that unique path is often through an endless series of hyper-specific choices.
Think about something as simple as ordering a coffee. In a highly individualistic consumer culture, you don't just ask for coffee.
Oh, no. You ask for a grande half-calf oat milk latte with 2 pumps of sugar-free vanilla heated to exactly 130 degrees.
Exactly. You're expected to customize every single atom of your existence.
That is a perfect, granular example of the significant burden the text mentions. When your identity is forged by millions of micro-decisions like that, the cognitive load is just relentless.
Now, contrast that with a collectivist culture. In collectivist societies, which are prevalent across many parts of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the primary unit of society is not the individual, but the group.
The family, the community, the corporation, or the nation.
So the cultural priority shifts from standing out to fitting in. Harmony, mutual obligation, and shared traditions take precedence over infinite personal customization.
Exactly. And because the social framework provides a set of expectations and norms, many decisions are essentially pre-made or heavily guided by the community.
The individual is not expected to completely invent their identity from scratch every single morning.
Right. Now, I need to pause here and ask a critical reading comprehension question for our listener.
Okay, lay it on us.
When the text says that people in collectivist cultures report higher levels of contentment, is the author making a definitive universal claim? Are they stating that collectivist societies are simply happier, better, and more psychologically healthy than individualistic ones?
I am thrilled you flagged that, because recognizing the scope of a claim is so essential for academic reading. If you see a multiple-choice option on the TOEFL that says the author argues collectivist cultures are universally happier, you must recognize that as a trap.
The author is absolutely not making a sweeping universal judgment like that.
So what are the boundaries of the author's claim here?
We have to look at the surrounding context. The text states, this dynamic suggests that understanding cultural differences in consumer psychology can help businesses.
The key parameter is consumer psychology.
Yes. The contentment being reported is highly localized to the experience of decision-making and consumer behavior.
Ah, I see. The author is saying that because individuals in a collectivist culture are not crushed by the expectation to maximize every single choice, because they don't have to navigate 50 types of laptops and 24 types of jam to validate their existence, they avoid the severe decision fatigue that plagues individualistic cultures.
They are contented in relation to the burden of choice.
Precisely. It is a highly specific observation about cognitive load, not a philosophical declaration about the ultimate way to structure human civilization.
Let's examine the vocabulary used to construct this final argument. The text says, the paradox also has broader implications. We know broad means wide or expansive. What exactly are implications in this context?
An implication is a conclusion that can be drawn from something, although it is not explicitly stated. It refers to the secondary or tertiary effects of a core action.
Like a stone hitting a pond. The stone hitting the water is the action. The ripple spreading outward are the implications.
Exactly. So the fact that an overabundance of choice causes anxiety isn't just an isolated problem for a guy buying a phone.
Yeah.
The ripples, the broader implications, affect how entire cultures construct their mental well-being and how global markets must operate.
Yes. And to pivot between these two cultural frameworks, the author uses a highly effective transition word, conversely.
Conversely. It sounds so much more authoritative than just saying but or on the other hand.
It really does. Conversely functions as a precise hinge in academic writing. It introduces a statement or idea that reverses the one that was just made.
The author outlines the burden of the individualistic culture and then uses conversely to immediately signal to the reader, prepare for the exact opposite scenario.
Right. In collectivist cultures, the burden is lifted. Using a word like conversely in your own essays demonstrates to graders that you have tight, deliberate control over the flow of your argument.
Write that down in your mental notebook, listeners. Add conversely to your active vocabulary toolkit. Now, how does the author wrap up this cultural analysis?
They note that businesses can use this understanding to optimize their product strategies. Optimize.
Optimize. We can trace this word back to the Latin root optimum, which means the best, the most favorable, or the ideal condition.
I always think of optimal as tuning an engine.
Oh, that's a good one. You tweak the air and fuel mixture until the engine produces the absolute maximum horsepower with the least amount of waste.
That's a highly accurate way to view it. To optimize a system or a strategy is to fine-tune its variables until it is as effective, perfect, or useful as it can possibly be.
In the context of global business, if a company wants to optimize its product strategy in an individualistic culture, it needs to figure out how to offer choice without triggering decision fatigue.
Perhaps by heavily curating the options, like we discussed.
And finally, the text refers to this entire complex interaction of culture, psychology, and economics as a dynamic. It says, this dynamic suggests.
I usually hear dynamic used as an adjective to describe someone with a lot of energy, like a dynamic public speaker. How is it functioning here as a noun?
Good question. When used as a noun in academic literature, a dynamic refers to a system of underlying forces or factors that stimulate change, growth, or behavior within a process. It implies motion and interconnectivity.
So it's not just a static fact.
No. The dynamic is the active shifting relationship between the number of choices available, the cultural background of the consumer, the limitations of the human brain, and the resulting level of anxiety or happiness. It's a complex web of cause and effect.
Recognizing that the author views this as an interacting system, a dynamic, rather than just a simple list of facts, is really key to profound reading comprehension.
So what does this all mean? We have taken a magnifying glass to the vocabulary, the psychology, and the sentence structures of this passage. Let's zoom out now and map the entire conceptual journey for our listeners so the big picture is flawlessly clear.
Mapping the flow of ideas is the absolute best way to solidify comprehension.
We began with the introduction of a counterintuitive theory, the paradox of choice. The author established that in consumer cultures, an overabundance of options does not create freedom. It creates a paralyzing cognitive overload known as decision fatigue.
And this fatigue diminishes our happiness because the fear of making the wrong choice, the weight of the opportunity cost, begins to haunt our decision-making process.
Following that, the author pivoted from theory to empirical evidence. We examined the famous supermarket jam experiment, which proved that human beings are easily overwhelmed by comparative computation.
A massive display of 24 jams paralyzed shoppers, while a curated, limited display of 6 jams eased the cognitive load, relieved the pressure of finding the perfect item, and resulted in significantly higher satisfaction and sales.
Finally, the author expanded the scope to global sociology, analyzing how different cultural frameworks handle this dynamic.
We saw that individualistic cultures, which demand infinite personal choices, place a heavy psychological burden on their citizens.
Conversely, collectivist cultures, which value group harmony over infinite individual customization, often shield their citizens from this specific type of decision fatigue, leading to higher contentment in consumer contexts.
That is a beautifully structured summary, and I want to pause to highlight the underlying architectural skeleton of this text because it is a pattern you will see repeatedly in academic reading.
Let's reveal the blueprint.
The structure is concept, followed by empirical evidence, followed by broader application.
Concept, evidence, application.
Precisely. The concept is Schwartz's paradox. The evidence is Iyengar's jam study. The application is the analysis of global consumer cultures.
If you can train your mind to recognize this three-part progression while you are reading, you will dramatically increase your reading speed.
You won't get lost in the details of the jam flavors because you'll know why the jam is there. It's just the evidence pillar holding up the concept roof.
That is an incredibly powerful strategy. When you see the architecture, you don't get trapped in the weeds.
Now, before we launch into our final thoughts, let's do a rapid-fire review of the most critical C1 vocabulary we unpacked today. These are the heavy hitters you need to remember.
I will throw out the word, and you give us the distilled high-impact definition. Ready?
Ready, let's do it.
Word number one.
Paradox.
A situation or statement that seems completely contradictory to common sense, but upon investigation, reveals a deeper truth. Like the fact that more freedom of choice makes us feel trapped. Word number two. Overabundance.
An extreme, unmanageable excess of something. Way more than is needed. Resulting in overwhelm.
Word number three, diminish.
To decrease, to erode, or to gradually reduce the size or intensity of something, like how choice chips away at our contentment.
Word number four,
curating.
The deliberate, expert process of selecting, organizing, and presenting a limited number of items to relieve the user of the burden of choice.
And word number five, conversely.
A powerful transition adverb used to flip the script and introduce a scenario that is the exact opposite of the one just described.
Flawless. I hope our listeners were echoing those definitions right along with us.
Now, we always strive to bring these dense academic topics back down to earth because the reality is you are living inside this reading passage every single day.
Oh, absolutely. Whether you are trying to decide which university to attend, which insurance plan to buy, or simply staring blankly at a streaming service for 40 minutes trying to pick a movie, you are wrestling with the paradox of choice. It really is the defining psychological friction of the modern era. But the beauty of understanding the academic theory behind it is that you can use it to hack your own brain.
How so?
If you find yourself paralyzed by decision fatigue, you can artificially engineer a curated environment. If you are shopping for a laptop, don't look at 50.
Right. Force yourself to pick between 3 models selected by an expert reviewer and then just close the browser.
Embrace being a satisficer instead of a maximizer.
Give yourself permission to make a good choice instead of a perfect choice. I love that. But as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, our listeners, with a slightly more provocative thought to chew on. Something that extends beyond the boundaries of the text.
Let's hear it.
The text makes it very clear that the business world understands this phenomenon. Sheena Iyengar's jam study is legendary in marketing circles. Retailers know, as an empirical fact, that curating choices eases cognitive load, makes consumers happier, and actually drives higher sales.
Yes. The data is undeniable. Everyone knows it.
So, if the data is undeniable, and every major corporation knows it, why do modern digital platforms behave in the exact opposite manner?
What do you mean?
Think about the massive global e-commerce sites we interact with daily. If you go to one of these sites and search for a simple item, like a white cotton t-shirt, the algorithm doesn't curate 6 excellent options for you.
No, it bombards you with tens of thousands of search results across 300 pages.
That is a brilliant observation.
Yeah.
It directly contradicts the lesson of the jam experiment.
Exactly. If they know that thousands of choices trigger decision fatigue and anxiety, why is the architecture of the digital world designed to provide infinite choice? Are the tech giants simply ignoring decades of psychological research?
Or, and this is the slightly sinister thought, are they weaponizing our decision fatigue?
Oh, that is a fascinating avenue of inquiry. Are they intentionally maxing out our cognitive RAM?
Think about it. When you are staring at 10,000 white t-shirts, your brain crashes. You experience decision fatigue. You just want the pain of choosing to end. And what is conveniently sitting at the very top of the page, highlighted in a slightly different color.
The sponsored item.
The product that a company paid the platform to put right in front of your exhausted eyes.
So the theory is that by intentionally overwhelming you with an overabundance of choice, they break down your analytical defenses, making you highly susceptible to taking the easiest, algorithmically promoted path out of the anxiety.
They aren't curating to help you. They are overwhelming you to steer you.
It is a dark thought, but a highly plausible one when you understand the dynamic of consumer psychology. Are we being paralyzed by design?
I am going to be observing my own reactions very closely the next time I shop online. And I encourage you, the listener, to do the same. Look at the digital environments you interact with daily.
Ask yourself, is this platform acting as a thoughtful curator, or is it an engine designed to induce decision fatigue?
That is exactly the kind of critical, expansive thinking that takes you from merely reading a text to truly analyzing the world around you. And then with that thought, we have thoroughly unpacked Article 02. We hope you walk away from this deep dive with a powerful grasp of the vocabulary, the structures, and the profound psychology we explored today. This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio. Until next time, keep upgrading your English.